From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, how massive open online courses are transforming the relationship between universities and the general public. Later, we'll look at the present and future of Wisconsin's biking scene. Plus, the NFL and GE Healthcare work on improving MRI technology.
Specific to traumatic brain injury, it is also a tool that's used, but it's not, I believe, has the resolution or capabilities that's needed today to do a better evaluation of somebody who may be concussed or who's had a traumatic brain injury.
And former Packer Leroy Butler tries to eliminate bullying by creating role models.
I always talk to the athletes in the schools or the churches or whatever and say, this is your school, this is your playground. Don't let this kind of stuff go on.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. You've probably heard a lot about how distance learning is transforming education. College students take some of their courses while they're in pajamas in their dorm rooms. And virtual high schools exist virtually around Wisconsin, attracting kids who are otherwise left behind by the traditional classroom. But another aspect of virtual education is gaining a foothold as big-name universities extend their brand. Massive open online courses, or MOOCs, allow hundreds or thousands of students to take courses from leading schools around the world, though not typically with an aim towards a traditional college degree. Earlier this month, the Greater Milwaukee Committee brought together several university presidents from the area to discuss the future of MOOCs with national expert Chris Westfall. Westfall joined us in the studio as well. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you, Mitch. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is it about education and society today, at this point in time, that makes the time right for MOOCs in your eyes?
Well, the idea of time is very interesting. If you take people from different professions, if you had a time machine and you could bring people from 100 years ago, if you could bring a police officer from 1913 into this century, that individual would be completely mystified as to how to do his or her job in the current era. But if you were to bring a professor of Renaissance history to 2013, that individual will be perfectly comfortable in the modern classroom. Of course, there will be some technologies and things that will be a mystery, but essentially the way that education has been delivered, particularly higher education in this country for more than 100 years, there's been no change. And MOOCs, or massive open online courses, represent a tectonic shift in the way that people access education. MOOCs are located at the intersection of commerce, in other words, what businesses expect, what students expect, and what colleges, or at least some colleges, are able to deliver.
Paint a picture of how MOOCs are working. This is still fairly early in the era of MOOCs. What do they look like today, and where do you see them going?
Well, first, to define what a MOOC is, a massive open online course is designed to offer free access to a large student population to a particular skill. And MOOCs actually started in 2011 when Stanford University decided to offer an online course into artificial intelligence. And 160,000 people signed up for the course. So that's where we are right now in terms of what it means is this accessibility. And 23,000 people actually completed that course. So it's given rise to a number of organizations now that offer these online courses. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's sort of a background for
– And there are key – I mean distance learning, sort of traditional distance learning has been around for a long time. There are some key differences between a massive open online course and what we think of as traditional distance learning.
Well, there are several, but the key difference is flipping the classroom. In a traditional model, the classroom represents the place for the sage on the stage, if you will, the lecture hall for the professor to share their knowledge. MOOCs flip the classroom in that the lecture is recorded. The lecture is watched and viewed as homework. So what actually happens in the online course is delivered in a shorter format and focuses on greater activity for the students. So it's really an opportunity for one-on-one work for the actual problem solving to take place. So in that regard, the classroom is flipped. So what we think of as homework has changed, so has what we think of as being in the traditional classroom. And in fact, if you want to know what the traditional classroom is going to look like in the world of MOOCs, you hold it in your hands and it has a flat screen on it and you type on a digital keyboard. That's the world that we're moving to, and that's the way that students want to access knowledge.
Well, how is that one-on-one activity working? Because presumably the university or the college that's offering the course and the person who's really running it isn't going to sit there and grade 130,000 papers.
What's so exciting about MOOCs is that they harness the power of social, and they create an opportunity for students to help students. So there is, as you can imagine, in a group of 160,000, there is an opportunity to create subgroups, study groups, an opportunity to create questions and answers, you know, because students are going to have similar questions. So MOOCs really are about, again, using technology in more meaningful, more compelling ways to take advantage of some of the things that we see in social, like, that, for example, like Facebook groups, but turning that into a platform that helps students to help themselves in a spirit of sharing, which is also behind the whole initiative for MOOCs.
What about quality control? Without, say, a bricks and mortar advisor there to guide your MOOC education, how are the right would-be students connecting with the right classes?
Well, quite frankly, Mitch, the jury's still out on that. And one of the challenges that MOOCs face is not only in quality control but also cheating. Cheating has been a real problem in the coursework. But there are some things that can be designed into the courses to help. For example, some of the organizations that are offering MOOCs, such as Coursera, Udacity, and others, have online tools to track where students are stumbling. So not only are they able to know where perhaps in a video or in a lesson or in a quiz there are challenges that keep coming up over and over again and actually tweak and adjust their teaching to make it more effective, but they have an opportunity to know in no uncertain terms where students are struggling and provide feedback for things like and even rewards for things like persistence. Because if I turn in an assignment on a math problem, for example, you don't know how many times I tried to solve that problem before I got to the answer I came up with. But if I'm doing that online, guess what? You do. And you can see my challenges in new and more meaningful ways. So it is true that it's difficult for one teacher to address the needs of 10,000 or 100,000 students. But by using these online tools and by using technology, when any media platform gets translated through the internet, it changes. And so that's part of the challenge that we're seeing now for MOOCs is what is that change going to look like and how can we use technology in a more meaningful way so that there can be quality control, there can be standards. And another way that they can inject quality control in there is by offering certifications, in other words, for competency. I mean, it's one thing to take a course, but it's quite another to be able to prove that you can speak Spanish, for example. There needs to be some sort of testing element to prove competency as well.
And so the next step perhaps is the bottom line. What are they getting out of it? Is the idea to have a certified skill set that comes out of it or simply to broaden their education?
I think it's both, but the certified skill set is really the thing that is compelling, at least on the student side. And it creates some challenges for traditional universities as they look at themselves, I believe, as an institution, as they should, not a trade school. So if they are producing MOOCs that provide skills, how do we make sure that we're, as a university, providing critical thinking skills, not just capabilities and sort of trade school sort of things? Not that there's anything wrong with that. But for traditional universities, it can be a challenge. The key is to provide competency, some sort of certification. And we have certifications out there. If you're going to be a lawyer, you have to take the bar exam. A CPA, there are certifications that you have to have. What about similar standards for courses in marketing or nursing, for example? And those certifications, those standards have to be in place in order for MOOCs to be effective. And you ask about the bottom line too. And those certifications are really a place or an opportunity for the revenue model behind MOOCs to take place, because as you remember, MOOCs are a free platform. That's how they're designed. It's, you know, come one, come all. But when it comes time for the certification, that's where there can be charges. And again, there are different business models, and I'm not trying to say that this is a one-size-fits-all, because MOOCs are about specificity and creating a specific curriculum for specific needs. But in general, the certification opportunity. And when you're an organization like Khan Academy that has over 4 million users, you know, if they charge even $10 for a certification and only 25% of their student population takes advantage of that, that's still a very, very large number.
And so without certification being a standard part of the equation yet, what are the colleges and universities and other institutions that are offering these courses getting from it? How much of it right now is about brand building?
Brand building is really key. And there are universities right here like the University of Wisconsin-Madison that is offering and exploring what it means to provide these programs and other schools in the area as well. So what we're seeing from the thought leaders at Harvard, MIT, Stanford, some of the leaders in this space who dip their toe into the water first is that they view it, I believe, as an opportunity to really establish themselves as the arbiter of knowledge at the top tier level. So it's an opportunity that exists as well for other schools here in Wisconsin and across the country to provide that same sort of thought leadership. And that thought leadership is really what students, I believe, are looking for. I mean, ultimately, there's no replacement for the experience of being on campus, going to football games, going to parties, you know, those kinds of things. But for students and also for the parents who are paying for the students to go to a traditional college experience, ultimately the goal is, what is the credential? What is the capability? What do you have that you didn't have before in terms of critical thinking that can translate into a meaningful contribution in terms of a salary or starting your own business or whatever your goals may be?
And so if the idea isn't necessarily that MOOCs are going to supplant the bricks and mortar education, is it more likely that the people that are going to be pursuing opportunities through these massive open online courses will already have a higher education in their background?
Perhaps. What's changing for the university environment is this concept of lifelong learning. I mean, the idea that a college sophomore is 20 years old is yesterday's news. I mean, that individual could be a 37-year-old mother of two. It could be a 14-year-old prodigy. Who knows? But the market is asking for the ability to access the benefits of a Marquette education, for example, a powerful brand, but to be able to access that from La Crosse or Two Rivers or some other city where you don't necessarily have to be on campus. And what about for the working professional that would like to study and work on problems at 10 o'clock at night or 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon? That's the viability and that's the expansiveness that MOOCs can offer. It can't replace the college experience, but what the college experience is changing.
Have you taken a MOOC?
Interestingly enough, I have created a course. I've dipped my toe into the water. I have created a course on a platform called Udemy, udemy.com, and it's a course designed to help you to communicate and pitch a business idea as an elevator pitch guy. Imagine that. I have a course to help you to pitch more effectively, and it's something that I've created with Jeffrey Hazlett, who is a contributing editor on Bloomberg TV, and he's also the host of the C-Suite with Jeffrey Hazlett. So we've combined our resources and created about 110 minutes of video, live video instruction, as well as interactive quizzes that are available on udemy.com. It's a pay-to-play platform, so it's not a MOOC in the traditional or pure definition of it. But what a MOOC really is remains to be seen. But our platform targets really a business audience and people who are looking to – they have an idea that they want to pitch more effectively, and that's what this online course is designed to do. And again, it's just been out for a little over a month, so we're just dipping our toe into the water.
And I would imagine, like anything that really takes advantage of the internet, this entire model could look completely different 5 years from now, 10 years from now.
It's impossible to predict what this model is going to become. In fact, I was talking with someone who I really respect and maybe the listeners need to know about, a guy by the name of Jose Bowen. Jose Bowen is the author of a book called Teaching Naked, and he's the dean of the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU. And he's a friend of mine. And I called him and I said, you know, Jose, what course can't be taught on a MOOC? Can you learn to play the violin, or can you learn to diagnose pleurisy, or can you learn how to draw blood effectively from a massive online course? What can't you learn? And he said, quite frankly, I don't know, and neither does the marketplace. And really what this whole educational initiative means, and it means to the people listening into the schools here in the Milwaukee area and the state of Wisconsin and beyond, you have to ask yourself, how will you help to define what MOOCs mean? And educators for years have served as curators of content, meaning that as a college professor, you don't necessarily create everything that the students absorb. Even if you've written the textbook, you refer them to resources and that sort of thing. And so as content creators move into content curators, it's education's job to point people in the right direction and to have access to those resources. And the world-class resources define the world-class university, define the world-class education. And MOOCs are yet another resource that people can tap into and provide the kind of accessibility that fits students at all points in their lifetime and at all points in their career. So for me, the way that I view MOOCs and these new technological initiatives is as a very expansive platform and as an inclusive platform. Figuring out how to monetize it, figuring out how to produce it, because obviously, it's one thing to create an hour-long lecture. It's quite another to create an hour of video, interactive quizzes, tracking mouse clicks, et cetera. And there are platforms to help to do that. But those are the puzzles that are being solved every day. And then I think anyone who wants to play in this space and any university who's going to participate, and many of them here in Wisconsin already are, they have to continue to solve those problems and ask themselves, how will we be a part of this?
Chris Westfall, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. It's a pleasure.
Chris Westfall is a national expert on massive open online courses, or MOOCs, and also holds the distinction of being national elevator pitch champion. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk with area university leaders about MOOCs in an event convened by the Greater Milwaukee Committee. We'll take stock of the state of the bicycle universe, or at least this corner of it, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. A week ago today, several hundred cycling advocates found themselves in one place in Madison. It was not a traffic jam, but rather the annual summit put together by the Bicycle Federation of Wisconsin. Two people in significant roles in Wisconsin cycling are also pretty new to the scene. Kristen Bennett came last spring from Colorado Springs to become the city of Milwaukee's Bicycle and Pedestrian Transportation Coordinator. Dave Shislavich is the former mayor of Madison. He came on board recently as executive director of the Bicycle Federation of Wisconsin. Ahead of the summit, the two chatted with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz about their visions for building the bicycle climate here. Shislavich says the Bike Federation's focus includes epic mountain bike destinations and an interconnected state bikeway system.
Commuting is also a big part of our agenda. We call it Platinum Cities. We call them Platinum Cities because the League of American Bicyclists rates cities, platinum, gold, silver, bronze. And Milwaukee's a bronze city. Madison's gold. And we would like to
have... I wasn't going to bring that up right away.
Well, I used to be the mayor.
I thought we'd build that tension.
Yeah, I used to be the mayor of Madison, so I can't help myself. But
Kristen, don't worry. We'll give you a chance.
But Milwaukee's a great cycling town, getting better. And our goal, though, at the Bike Fed is to get as many cities as possible as high on that list as possible. So great cities to bike in for recreation, but also great cities to bike in for commuting with all the benefits that come with that. And then road biking. A lot of people don't know that one of the reasons that Wisconsin is such a great place to ride a bike on a rural road is the dairy industry. The reason that we've got so many great paved roads and town roads especially in the state of Wisconsin is because when you're milking cows and it gets to be March and April, you got to get through and mud and gravel just won't do it. And so it's because of the dairy industry that we have such great paved roads all over the state. That combined with the topography make Wisconsin really an outstanding place for road biking.
So, Kristen, you come to us by way of Colorado Springs.
Right. I was the Bicycle and Pedestrian Transportation Manager in Colorado Springs for 8 years.
Talk about your philosophy of how you get people, how you inspire them to get on their bikes or get on their feet.
I mean, I think a lot of it is when you actually put the facilities on the ground and the support facilities like bicycle parking, good quality bicycle maps, good information resources, great signage. People do find their way out onto these facilities. Even before we've had problems this summer when we were constructing the new KK River Trail pieces. We literally were posting out through social media, please stay off. We're still under construction. Stop taking the tape down.
I saw that.
You know, so it was, there's a real desire to have more and more places to ride bicycles, designated places, separated places throughout the city. So
Milwaukee is – it's come a long way for both biking and pedestrian. But there's challenges here.
There's challenges in every community. It's just a function of, you know, what you have to assess what people's priorities are. Milwaukee is a very different place than Colorado Springs. And so I can take away a lot of lessons from other cities I've been to and other colleagues I know from other cities. We can look a lot more to, say, a Chicago or a Minneapolis, St. Paul than we can really even to Madison sometimes. They're just really divergent communities in how they were built and their sizes and just kind of how they are laid out. I think we have a lot of opportunity here because Milwaukee is a city of strong, gridded neighborhoods, which really is an asset for getting people around.
So is one of the great challenges just universally funding? Is it getting those federal dollars and have them trickle your way through the state?
Funding is always a challenge, no matter what kind of transportation or what kind of project you have. We've done fairly well. We're continuing to go after more dollars. I think the biggest challenge is that often bicycling projects and pedestrian projects can often be very small scale. So assigning them to complicated federal grants sometimes takes more effort than often is worth leveraging those dollars. So it's sort of a function of packaging projects together and also being ready to go and get as many small improvements with other people's projects as you can. So if someone's paving a road, can we modify the striping without a major grant involved? Using whatever other projects we have going on to make little changes along the way.
So are there any projects on the horizon that you want to talk about, or are we not quite there with new stuff?
No, there's a lot of projects on the horizon. We finished 24 miles of new bike lane this year, courtesy of some federal grant dollars. We obviously just opened up a section, the first section of the KK River Trail, which is part of the larger downtown of Bayview connection. We're going to add another slate of bike lanes next year with the rest of that grant I mentioned. We are working very closely with a local nonprofit, Midwest Bike Share, on bringing public bike sharing to Milwaukee, hopefully next year. That's going quite well. We just met an hour ago with the county. I did on updating the bike maps that we have a partnership with them on. And we're doing an extension to the Beer Lion Trail up in the Harambe neighborhood that it's coming over the next about 18 months.
I wanted to ask you about the status of platinum, silver, and how coveted that is.
It's very competitive. The last time the League of American Bicyclists went out for applications, over 500 cities applied. And I think only about 200 were designated at some level. So it's very competitive. The league takes this very seriously. And I'll tell you what, mayors take it very seriously. Even mayors I knew who hadn't been on a bike in 30 years, they wanted their city to be platinum. Mayors are sort of competitive by nature. But one of the reasons they are, whether or not they personally are bikers or not, is that they realize that being designated a great biking city is good to sell their city to a lot of folks who actually look at that as one measure of quality of life. There's a lot of folks out there who can really live anywhere, and they choose cities based on the quality of life. And one of the things they look at, one of the key factors they look at, is whether or not it's a bike-friendly city. Because of what I said earlier, it relates to a lot of other things that people are looking for.
So, Kristen, what was the program that you said you're going to launch next year, Bike Share?
Well, we're keeping our fingers crossed. Numerous cities around the world and now more and more around the country are developing public bike share systems. These are very different from the early systems where somebody would paint some bikes yellow and put them out and, you know, you rely on the generosity and honesty of people to put them back. This is now all very automated. It's card key systems, and you go to different stations throughout dense areas of the community and you check out a bike. So say you took the bus in from your house in the morning as part of your commute, but you wanted to ride up to another location for a meeting or maybe to meet someone for lunch or to run an errand, you could walk down the street and check out a bike.
So what needs to happen for that to push through?
I
suppose.
We actually have some money. Midwest Bike Share is a concerted group of citizens who formulated that nonprofit. We're working in partnership with them with their fundraising capabilities. We've recently received a federal grant, and a lot of it is now just getting through the steps of putting out bids and deciding on station locations and operation requirements and performance measures. And there's a lot to it. You're running essentially an individualized public transit system. And it needs to be highly reliable, provide great service, and be quick and easy to use. And so putting that on the ground in the right places and making sure that that kind of service can be provided is critical.
So, Dave, what do you look forward to next in your new career with the Bike Fed?
I'm really excited about what we can do at the local level because the kinds of things that Kristen is working on in the city of Milwaukee are very tangible. And what we know is that about 60% of the population is interested in riding a bike but concerned, and they're concerned mostly about their safety. And if you can make them feel safe and be safe, usually through an infrastructure investment, they're going to ride. We just know a lot more people are going to ride. And it's great that we've got so many, you know, competitive cyclists out there and, you know, Lycra guys, and that's wonderful. But what I'd really like to see is more families on bikes, more women on bikes, more guys in suits on bikes going to work. If you go to countries like the Netherlands, you know, like Denmark, like Germany, you'll see people riding all over the place and not necessarily dressed in Lycra, but just riding their bikes because that's their basic form of transportation. That's how you get shares of travel. We call it mode share. That's how you get mode shares of 30, 40, 50%. And so what I'm excited about is the kind of work that Kristen's doing at the local level to provide the education, the enforcement, the infrastructure to get more people on their bikes every day.
I mean, I think there's a huge amount of opportunity to improve things in Milwaukee. I mean, when I came here, I was like, wow, I got a lot done already. Great. But there's, you know, I think it was only the tip of the iceberg and the rest of it is still floating under the ice in terms of what's really able to be accomplished. And we're having a lot more conversations about building, you know, bike boulevard network, using our grid and using our lower volume collector streets, which is going to be more attractive to that interested but concerned group. It's great to put the bike lanes on our bigger, busier streets. It's all about a network, and it's about putting that together. But we're also looking at, you know, what other kind of trail connections. Can we take what we have and actually make it more user-friendly, make intersections better? Can we take existing bike lanes and make them separated? You know, so some of it is graduating the system up from its early inception to something even more enhanced.
Former Madison Mayor Dave Sislavich is the Executive Director of the Bicycle Federation of Wisconsin. Kristen Bennett is the City of Milwaukee's Bicycle and Pedestrian Transportation Coordinator. They spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. How one area company is working to better diagnose brain injuries in professional and someday in amateur athletics. That story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The Green Bay Packers season continues Monday night with a showdown against the rival Chicago Bears. But the struggle is a different one for players who have sustained head injuries. Earlier in the week, we spoke with former Packer George Kuntz about his work on the struggles former players face with injury and depression after they leave football. But the NFL points to proactive measures it says it is taking to protect players today. One of those is a partnership, the Head Health Initiative, with the Milwaukee area's GE Healthcare. It provides funding for developing the next generation of MRI devices, which could make diagnosing brain injuries easier. Baldev Ahuwalia is the premium segment manager in MRI for GE Healthcare. He joined us in September. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Mitch. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
What what is the ultimate aim of this partnership that the GE has entered into with the NFL?
Well, Mitch, it has multiple goals. The first goal is to improve our understanding and education of traumatic brain injury and make sure we can better understand how it's diagnosed and what the prognosis would be. The second one is to understand what technologies could be better used to better detect traumatic brain injury. And the third one is product development, taking our understanding and learning from both clinical research and development and product development and apply that into products and make it available in the marketplace.
Where does the technology currently stand? What's the weak point that you're seeking to address that can make things better?
It's a very interesting question. You know, MR is an incredibly sensitive tool today. It is probably one of the most sensitive tools to evaluate and look at the brain. It is also one of the later stages or tools used in the diagnosis or determine what treatment should be used for a patient. And in specific to traumatic brain injury, it is also a tool that's used, but it's not, I believe, has the resolution or capabilities that's needed today to do a better evaluation of somebody who may be concussed or who've had a traumatic brain injury.
Well, and let's take a step even further back than that. We talk about MRI, it stands for magnetic resonance imaging, but what exactly is it? In a nutshell, how does it work?
Well, an MRI, as you said, magnetic resonance imaging, uses a very strong magnetic field and radio waves to look at really the distribution of water in the tissue, how the water or protons specifically is bound to different types of tissue, white matter, gray matter, fat, cerebral spinal fluid in your blood, and look how that changes over different parameters. So there typically in an MRI exam when you may go in the brain, a physician will maybe prescribe 5 or 6 different ways of looking at the brain. And they'll use those 5 or 6 different methods of looking at the brain to put together a puzzle to determine what the issue may be. Sometimes they'll do an acquisition which is very sensitive to blood, sometimes an acquisition which is very sensitive to white matter or gray matter in the brain. And they'll compose a picture to determine what the diagnosis would be.
So when you're talking about being able to improve the resolution in order to achieve stronger results, what are we able to see today and what might we be able to see given this partnership and further developments in the field?
Well, today we can see many impressive things. We can see stroke incredibly well. We can see how the brain is perfused with blood very well. We can see anatomical changes well. But what we don't understand clearly is all the things that may change specifically with concussion, what's the rate of change, and how sensitive does the device need to be so that we can accurately monitor that change over time. In preparation for this meeting, you highlighted functional magnetic resonance imaging. And that is a very exquisite tool and a very sensitive tool for looking at changes and minute changes in blood flow based on, activation of area parts of the brain. That is one tool today that we will be advancing to improve the diagnostic or prognostic capabilities of an MRI scanner to evaluate traumatic brain injury. The other ones are, things like microbleeds. Depending upon the level of impact or the type of concussion, you can have very small microbleeds. It is felt, I should say, that there can be small microbleeds based upon the severity of the concussion. And if there are microbleeds, it may take you longer to recover. We had a medical advisory board in May of this year. And the medical advisory board was made up of people from the NCAA, the NFL medical advisories, the Department of Defense, good partners of General Electric. And what it is product development is a team sport. And this is not something that we can do alone. We need really good partners and partners across multiple facets. One of those critical goals, as at the beginning, is understand and improve our understanding and education of how MR may be applied to evaluate and improve traumatic brain injury. And that's the part of the medical advisory board. They're collaborators with us, and they help us understand where else we should look and improve the capabilities of the scanner to then migrate what should go into product and why.
We think about the number of people, the very high-profile people who are dealing with traumatic brain injury are often NFL players, other sports as well. Is one of the roles that the NFL is going to be playing in this partnership, are they providing you with athletes who are in need of this kind of diagnosis?
No, they're not providing athletes in need of the diagnosis. That is specifically the responsibility of the research and development is General Electric. It's a partnership with the NFL to help us understand what might be best applied in their realm. But the goals here is not specific to the NFL. The goal for General Electric is to improve the capabilities for anybody who may need the technology, whether that be, my son when he's out riding his bike or a car accident on the playing field, the Department of Defense. It's very much a very broad spectrum. It's not a focused solution that we're looking for.
How much of what needs to be done is technology that may already exist in its infancy and needs the funding to scale up. And how much of this is about technology that does not even exist yet?
It's a bit of both. There is technology that we have today in-house. Coming from a research development background, technology only has a benefit when you put it in the hands of a clinician. It's one thing to have it running as a prototype at an evaluation site, but it only has the significant positive impact when you move it to the hands of a clinician and they get to use it every day or in the cases that they have.
If your child was injured, had a head injury, how confident would you be that the MRI that they get when they're taken to the doctor the next day is able to detect the severity of what's wrong with them?
I think it's also why you have tertiary care centers and more outpatient facilities. You know, in those situations, you want to take them to the best facility that is available to you and trust the physicians that you have. And I would trust that they have the capabilities, and they would have the capabilities to understand what best to do.
Is the objective to have equipment then that could exist at any given football stadium or in many, many, many more hospitals so that an athlete who is injured or whoever who is injured has access to this, or is this still going to be the kind of thing that will exist primarily at say trauma centers?
No, I think this is key technology that will become available to a broad spectrum of facilities. And when I say facilities, I mean healthcare providers. And it's not going to be solely to trauma centers because the follow-up from traumatic brain injury is not necessarily days or weeks. It is years in some situations. And the technology is available, I believe, from an evaluation standpoint, from a long-term chronic management of traumatic brain injury, that it can be done at a more outpatient facility. It's the continual evaluation and understanding of the changes over time that MR does not do incredibly well today, or we don't use those tools well today. MR is traditionally a very qualitative exam, and it's moving relatively rapidly towards a quantitative tool.
The NFL has another simultaneous partnership going with the equipment manufacturer Under Armour to look at improving safety through equipment. Is there any overlap in the Venn diagram, if you will? Is there a connection between what they're doing with equipment and what you are doing with diagnosis and treatment?
We are partners, and the partners with Under Armour and partners with the NFL, a lot of that information is very easily and quickly shared. So if somebody comes out with a brand new type of mouth guard that they suspect or believe will reduce the severity of a concussion, it may not have a play in what we do, but getting that to market is a critical thing.
This is a huge deal in professional sports and amateur sports today, in military settings. Is it an exciting challenge to be taking on?
It's a very exciting challenge, and it's also really important for trauma. You know, trauma is probably the biggest cause of traumatic brain injury globally, and when in the United States, it's anything on wheels or anything associated with wheels. It's very exciting. Anytime I talk to the team or any friend or colleague about what we're doing with traumatic brain injury, they all say, I know somebody, or it's affected me this way personally. So it's very strong. With that emotion comes high motivation. And if it's the rate of change is so great, then all the better.
This is a partnership with many different stakeholders. But what do you see the NFL doing in the context of this partnership?
In the context of the partnership, well, primarily we have common goals in this partnership. The primary role is funding. You know, it's a joint development. GE is putting in $30 million. The NFL is putting in $30 million. And that $30 million goes to three things. One is challenge grants to quickly migrate technology that's in the hands of anybody who has intellectual property and move that into the marketplace or advance it so that it could potentially be better evaluated. Completing research and development. So there's $10 million to clinical research and development to determine what should go into GE MRI products. And the last component is MRI product development in itself, which is $30 million. So the NFL's goals and GE goals in this joint development are common, and their responsibility is financial, which is equal in partnership with GE as well.
Are you anticipating – obviously things are early on in this partnership, but are you going to work with team physicians, say, and just talk to them about the kinds of challenges that they have? I mean, where are they going to be involved in any part of this, or is this essentially going to be a finished product by the time it gets to a football setting?
So there's a couple things. One is that we've actually worked very closely with University of Purdue. They have done a lot of work with high school players, and they work very closely with the athletic trainers who are on the sidelines, who are seeing the issues on a day-to-day basis and understanding how best to treat the patient. And they're also at the same time using MR to evaluate how the athlete, student-athlete, is progressing after the concussion. Are we working with team physicians? We're working with the NFL physicians. So there's team physicians, but predominantly they have, the NFL has a consultant group of three or four physicians. Specifically, we are working with the Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, and they are part of the Medical Advisory Board to make sure that we are fully aware of the research that is going on, as well as how the NFL is managing players today. And the NFL Players Association is engaged with that closely.
Baldev Ahluwalia, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Baldev Ahluwalia is the premium segment manager in MRI for GE Healthcare. The Milwaukee area company is partnering with the NFL to develop new MRI technology through the NFL's Head Health Initiative. We'll stick around the football world, but leave the injured list behind when Lake Effect returns. We'll catch up with Leroy Butler about his role with the Salvation Army, his anti-bullying campaign, and the anniversary of a certain touchdown celebration he pioneered. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. The Lambeau Leap turns 20 years old this season. The touchdown celebration in which a Packer launches himself into the adoring arms of fans behind the end zone was spontaneously invented by Leroy Butler after he scored a defensive touchdown against the then Los Angeles Raiders. Today, the tradition is famous around the league, even 12 years after Butler played his last game in Green Bay. Still, Butler is just as visible as he was then through his involvement in a number of levels in the Milwaukee community. He chairs this year's Red Kettle campaign for the Salvation Army and runs an anti-bullying program inspired by his own childhood. Leroy Butler joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
All right, thank you for having me.
Well, can we start with your latest project? This is the Be a Buddy, Not a Bully campaign. And I gather this is a personal issue for you, which I think might be a surprise to people who might not be able to imagine a guy who was a pro football player as the victim of bullying.
Yeah, it really was. I did my autobiography about it, and a lot of the things I left out was some of the things what happened to me when I was little. And basically, I was disabled. I had club feet. I spent time in a wheelchair, so I was an easy target for some of the kids. And my mom taught me to be strong. You know, and she taught me that God gave everybody this power. You don't give your power to anybody by being scared. You know, be a leader, not a follower. And I thought it was a good message to let kids know the reason why I got out of it, that situation, was because I taught everybody around me to be friends. You know, to do anything negative to anybody because they're disabled or they have autistic or for whatever reason they don't have much money and you have, it's really just crazy. And you're wasting a lot of negative energy. But if we become friends, then we find out that we both have a lot of things in common. We can get a lot of things accomplished. That most of these apps that you have put out now, they're mostly invented by people under 25 years old. So we need to spend time trying to make some money instead of going around doing negative things to people in school.
Well, and so where is that project? What is it? What kinds of things is it doing, and how many schools is it in?
Oh, it's so much fun. I think here's the focus of it. It's almost like a game show. We basically go to the school. I tell my story, and then I have little scripts that I write, and then I have three or four kids come out of the audience to remember the script for about 2 or 3 minutes. I give them a platform to basically tell their social issues. And because I don't think kids would gravitate towards another lecture or another assembly about something that they, you know, if it doesn't affect them, why would they care about it? But everybody wants to be famous. So Be a Buddy, Not a Bully gives the kids get a chance to talk about social issues and give them a chance to be famous. And also, we raise money for that particular school because those schools have a hard enough time selling candy and other fundraisers. It takes too much time to raise such a small amount of money. So what we try to do is raise money for the school so they can do scholarships or other programs they would like to do. And the kids, I repeat, the kids are over the budgeting, and they talk about some of the great things that they want to do. And one of these particular schools, they wanted to buy coats for some of the inner-city kids who did not have coats for this upcoming winter. And we're working with about 11 schools right now. So I'm just so excited to do some fun things, and that way the kids can feel like they're making a difference in their society.
Are the kids, when they meet you, are they amazed that you have this personal connection to having been bullied?
Yes, they're shocked because, as you pointed out and alluded to, they think most NFL guys are big, strong guys that for some reason – you know, you'd think that no one would bother you. But at some point, I had to start out as a kid. And, you know, and here's another point. I always talk to the athletes in the schools or the churches or whatever and say, this is your school. This is your playground. Don't let this kind of stuff go on. Because everybody wants to go to the high school football games on Friday, and they envy you. So start to be a leader by going to your school and say, listen, there's no violence involved. But if I see some bullying, if I hear some cyberbullying or Facebook or Twitter, I'm going to report it and I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen. Because what I don't like is these stories that I read of kids 12 to 15 years old killing themselves because a group of one culture, boys or girls, got together and began to torment them. I'm trying to put a stop to that.
It sounds like you're trying to create role models.
Absolutely. And that's exactly it. And that's what my mom told me. That's why I chose her as my role model. She said, be a leader, not a follower. But if you're going to be a follower, choose the right person to follow. And that resonated with me. That's why I chose Reggie White when he came to Green Bay Packers to follow him because he's a leader. But when he left the Green Bay Packers, I became a leader because I learned. I learned what a leader was all about. And that's the same thing that I can try to instill in the kids, in the schools, in the churches, and any place I think kids can, you know, be adapted. We also had 3 workplaces that adopted our campaign as well because they had some problems with adults bullying each other at work. And we kind of gave them our model and our program, and they've been doing a lot. And one of the programs, they raised money. And I was so fortunate because they raised money for a few of their colleagues. And when the government shutdown happened, they weren't getting paid. So they went to the fund that we helped them put together and was able to give a paycheck to 14 of their colleagues. That was one of the best sleeps I've had in the last 5 years. I was so excited because one of my programs helped somebody continue to make money for their family.
There are plenty of professional athletes who have gone and retired and, you know, maybe they make TV appearances now and then, go to celebrity golf tournaments or whatever, but that's it. Why is it so important for you to be involved at this grassroots level in the community?
Because my mom taught me just to be a leader. She taught me to help people. She also taught me that everybody that paid their hard-earned money to see me play with the Green Bay Packers, I need to give something back. I love this state. I love what it stands for. I love the people, and I want to be able to help. Sometimes I try to help too many causes or do too many things. So I say, you know what? I got to funnel it down to do what helped me in my life story, and that was networking. You could put me in a room of anybody, and after a while, the whole 1,000 people in that room will know who Leroy Butler is and what he stands for. And I like to give that to some of the kids because they're going to be our future. And I just really believe in what this state has to offer.
One of the other organizations you've got behind you, you're returning to your role as the honorary chair of the Red Kettle Campaign for the Salvation Army in Milwaukee. Why does that role make sense for you?
You know what? I got my first pair of new shoes from the Salvation Army. I remember my mom taking us to the Salvation Army to get some toys. And I wasn't a big toy kid. I think, hey, if they had some clothes or some shoes, that'd be great. So I went and got my first pair of brand new shoes from the Salvation Army. So when I got a chance to work with them, it was so much awesome. And November 1st starts the first time that you'll see people out there, you know, in rain, snow, sleet, it doesn't matter, ringing those bells to raise money. And our goal is to try to raise $5 million throughout the state to raise enough money for some of the programs. The Salvation Army is the largest organization for social programs. And not only that, it puts you in the spirit of Christmas coming up and the holidays when you see those people out there. And I can assure people, everybody ringing the bell is not on injured reserve like some of my Green Bay Packers friends. They'll be fine.
Well, and speaking of the Packers, before we go, I want to flash back to your days with the Packers for just a minute. We are coming up on the 20th anniversary of the Lambeau Leap, which started with you. Do you remember why you chose to take that first leap?
I have no idea. It was always spontaneous. Most of the stuff I do is spontaneous. I just remember wanting to do something exciting. You know, it was one of the coldest days in Packer history, and I'm running down the sideline. I got a lateral fumble from Reggie White, and I was running down, and I pointed to this guy and told him I was going to jump in the stands, and, you know, he had a beer in his hand, and he didn't know whether to catch me or what to do. And I remember him throwing a beer down as I jumped up there, and he yelled in my ear that I owed him a beer. I'll never forget that. So December 22nd coming up, I think the game is against Pittsburgh. That'll be like the 20 year that it was invented. So I'm really, really excited.
It has to be amazing to see what it's become, because everybody that's a football fan knows the Lambeau Leap.
Oh, no question about it. And it doesn't necessarily show up the opponent, but it does let our fans know that we love you guys. And the only chance we get a chance to hug you guys in our uniforms is during a game. So the Lambeau Leap is so good that other teams have adopted it, because everybody can't have 50-yard line seats. But I tell you what, when you're in the north and south end zones and you see your favorite player coming at you and he just jumps up there, you get a chance to high-five him. There's nothing better in the world.
Well, and given how long it's lasted, it's probably a good thing you didn't do something that was just embarrassing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But again, it's about the fans. It's 81,000 people on that list, so we're just so honored to be a part of it.
You mentioned injured reserve. How concerned are you about the health of your former team at this point?
Well, here's the problem. A lot of people want to say it's like 2010, and it is in a way. But the only difference, this many starters are out. That's the only difference. I mean, you got JaMychal Finley. He's not on injured reserve, but he's injured. And then you have Clay Matthews missing time, Nick Perry missing time, and then Randall Cobb is missing time, James Jones. I mean, these are all starters who are going to all be out at some point this season. I mean, it's kind of a head-scratcher that Ted Thompson once again proved that draft and development works. Because if this was a lot of these guys were high-priced free agents, there is no backup to that. So you would have been left with the bag empty, but the bag is always full when you guys got Nate Palmer out there that nobody knew who this guy was, but he started in the place of Matthews and Nick Perry. So, and Mutombo, you got these other guys that people don't know these guys, but for some reason, you know, Lattimore, these guys are stepping up, making plays, and it's making the Green Bay Packers a team to be reckoned with. And guess what? After all these injuries, they're in first place. Wow.
It is something to behold. Leroy Butler, thanks so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Leroy Butler was drafted by the Green Bay Packers in 1990. He played with them through the 2001 season. Today, he works on behalf of a variety of charitable causes, including his Be a Buddy, Not a Bully campaign and the Salvation Army's Red Kettle campaign, which kicks off tonight in Milwaukee. There's a link to more information from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. That is Lake Effect for, heaven help us, the first day of November. Don't forget to set your clocks back an hour between Saturday night and Sunday morning, or set them back right now and beat the rush, but you might be an hour late for everything for a while. We're produced by an always timely group of folks, including Stephanie Lecce, Dan Harmon, and Bonnie North, with assistance from Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster. John Stralecki is our studio engineer. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Have a great weekend, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.